We're talking about the vast majority of people, 10, 11 million employees who rely on wages and
Oh,
salaries
Troy,
for their living.
don't forget about those millionaires who don't pay any income taxes and get their franking credits.
Sorry.
They might not be as concerned as those 10 or 11 million workers.
That's a terrible oversight on my part.
One for mum, one for dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day. And welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute. In what was clearly a pre-election budget with lots of tax cuts and other sweeteners, there were two small words that were strikingly absent from the budget speech: wages growth.
If you've held out hope that the long run of stagnant wage growth is about to end, our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan has some disappointing news for you this morning.
Now, growth in the last quarter was up just 0.5 of 1% below forecasts. That's the second slowest pace since 1997.
In the first decade of this century, we had higher wages growth than most, but over the past 5 years, we've been in the bottom quarter.
In Australia, wages have been growing at the slowest pace since the end of World War II. They've barely kept up with consumer prices in that time. In this episode of Follow the Money, I'm joined by Jim Stanford, the director of the Australia Institute's Centre for Future Work, and Troy Henderson, economist at the Centre for Future Work, to talk about why wages aren't going up and what both major parties are promising to do about it this election year. Jim, what is happening with wages in Australia?
Nothing is happening with wages in Australia. That's the problem. Wages have been growing so slowly for the past several years. They really slowed down starting in about 2013, which coincidentally was the year the current government got elected. And we've seen a big decline in how fast wages are growing. Since then, they've been growing between 1 and 2% a year. That's slower than at any other period since the end of the Second World War. Mm. And for the vast majority of families, it's just not enough to pay the bills to keep up with rising consumer prices. So that's why calling it a wages crisis is not an exaggeration.
How does this compare historically? You've just said that it's the lowest that it's been kind of almost since World War II. But in the historical context, what are we talking about?
Well, wages, of course, go up and down depending on how the economy is doing. You know, every now and then you have a bad year for the economy, and that's when workers have a hard time getting good wage increases from their employers. But what's unique here is you've had 5 or 6 years in a row of very poor wage growth, 2% or less per year. Traditionally, in past decades, wages would be growing at 3.5%, 4%, 4.5%, sometimes even 5% a year. So you're seeing wages growing at really half of their traditional pace. And that seems like it shouldn't be happening. It seems like an anomaly. Consumer prices are still going up. Labor productivity is growing up. Wages should be going up, but they aren't.
And Troy, why is wages growth being so sluggish? Why is that actually a problem?
I think it's a problem for a whole lot of different reasons. For very obvious reasons, it's a problem if you rely, like most people do, on a wage to pay your mortgage, to pay your rent, to buy your groceries, to pay your electricity bills, all the normal things that people need in terms of their daily lives. But there's also a broader issue beyond individuals and households to do with its macroeconomic effect in Australia. So if we have depressed wages over a prolonged period of time, there's less money in people's pockets to go out and spend in Harvey Norman and the local pub or on childcare services, and to pump that injection of demand into the economy that ultimately creates jobs and drives our shared prosperity.
So, Jim, it's not just a problem for workers, but for the economy on the whole.
Indeed, there's lots of spillover effects that happen when wages are growing so slowly in terms of affecting overall economic performance and overall social conditions. So Troy mentioned the impact on consumer spending and overall demand. That can affect economic growth rates. That can affect job creation. It can also affect the revenues that government takes in because, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, but if you get more wages, then you're going to pay more income tax. And stronger wage growth is actually healthy for governments. Another spillover effect that's very damaging is the impact on inequality. We have seen that as overall wage growth slows, at the same time we're seeing growing gaps between a small number of people who are able, luckily, to get very good incomes and the rest of us whose wages are going nowhere. And that inequality, of course, has tremendous economic and social consequences as well. So it really is a challenge for the overall economy, not just for individuals who are trying to pay their bills.
As a society, the gap between those with the most and those with the least has been growing steadily.
500,000 low-income Australians are struggling to pay their rent.
Putting off your degree, studying part-time, because you need to work hours and hours to get through the week.
There has, over the last 30 years, been a big shift towards profits away from wages and other factors of production.
As Jim and Troy have said, the effect of slow wages growth is far-reaching across the economy, and it's widening the gap between high and low-income earners. Another fact that Jim's research has uncovered is that the share of the national income, or GDP, going towards workers has been dropping compared to the share of GDP going towards company profits. This again leads to all sorts of problems for the economy, and it increases inequality.
Workers are producing more real goods and services with each hour of their labour than they ever have, thanks to new technology and more efficient ways of organising production. So the actual size of the pie, if you like, is growing. But workers' share of that pie has gone nowhere because of this stagnation in wages. So with workers producing more but not getting more pay, what that means is the share of total GDP that goes to workers in the form of wages, salaries, superannuation contributions, and so on, has been shrinking. So think back to the mid-1970s. Workers were taking home about 56, 57, 58% of GDP in compensation. Today, that's down to just 47%, the lowest since the Australian Bureau of Statistics began gathering this data. And that means the share going to profits is higher. And that has contributed to the economic problems as well, because companies are taking in all these profits, but they're not reinvesting it in the domestic economy like they should be. And that's contributing to slower growth and slower job creation. So there's lots of ways this wages crisis really infects our overall well-being.
So workers are working harder, Troy, but not getting to share in the benefits of their hard work.
Absolutely not. And, you know, that really goes against, it's a bit of a cliche, but in Australia we've always talked about the fair go, we're the land of the fair go. So the benefits of prosperity should be shared equally between the workers who do the work and, of course, to a degree, the businesses who are investing and playing a role in creating jobs in the economy. But we can see that that system has grown massively out of whack over the last three or four decades.
And so that's the reason why people feel like they're not getting ahead.
I think that's right. And it's not just that they feel they're not getting ahead, they are actually not getting ahead.
Probably why they feel that way. And who cares about this problem apart from workers? Is it only unions who are concerned about this wages crisis?
No, certainly not. I think anyone who's concerned with the Australian economy doing well in a sort of sustainable, stable fashion is going to look at what's happening with wages and say that is not right and it can't be sustained. Even someone like Philip Lowe, he's the governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. In theory, you know, he's supposed to be one of the most cautious, prudent, boring people in the whole country. He's there to, you know, take away the punch bowl whenever the party gets fun. That's the Reserve Bank's role. And here he is saying, hey, wages are growing too slowly. It's slowing down overall consumer spending. It's making it impossible for us as the Reserve Bank to achieve our inflation target.
Whatever weight one chooses to place on these various cyclical and structural factors, it's clear that slow wage growth is affecting our economy.
So for anyone who's concerned with the economic and social well-being of the whole country, the wages crisis should be at the top of their agenda.
And when we say just workers being concerned about this issue, we are talking about, what is it, Jim, 10, 11 million employees and their families. So we're talking about the vast majority of people who rely on wages and salaries.
Oh, Troy, don't forget about those millionaires who don't pay any income taxes and get their franking credits.
Sorry.
They might not be as concerned as those 10 or 11 million workers.
That's a terrible oversight on my part.
Over recent times, there's been a mindset in many businesses that the key to higher profits is to reduce costs, and paying higher wages can sit at odds with that mindset.
In Melbourne, demonstrators brought the city to a standstill.
Union! You're working harder than ever, and you're going backwards. Trickle-down economics doesn't work. It's failed us all. It's time for decent wage increases. It's time for secure jobs.
Along with the Reserve Bank Governor, Philip Lowe, and the unions, it was the Australia Institute's Centre for Future Work who organised an open letter signed by 124 economists, policy experts and lawyers calling for the government to tackle the wages crisis. So what exactly can the government do to address this problem that wages aren't going up? Well, the open letter identified a short list of 5 things the government could do straight away to help boost wages and repair the economy.
That includes, first of all, government itself is a major employer, remember. The Commonwealth government and the state governments employ hundreds of thousands of people. And instead of trying to strangle wage growth within the public sector, as they've done with wage caps and so on, they should actually allow normal collective bargaining and allow wages to grow faster there. Secondly, we clearly need stronger minimum wages. The minimum wage right now is too low. It would allow someone working full-time to still be in poverty. So we need to raise the wage, and we also need to enforce that minimum wage so that you don't have this problem of wage theft, you know, in franchises and companies that aren't even recognizing the minimum wage. Another thing that has to change is our collective bargaining and industrial relations system is really falling apart. Only about 12% of workers in private sector workplaces today have the protection of an enterprise agreement. And if you don't have a contract like that, you're probably not going to get a wage increase because, you know, as an individual, you've got very little bargaining power to go to your boss and say, give me more money. We've also looked at, those 124 experts looked at this whole problem of what's called a fissured workplace. The fact that companies are outsourcing so much of what they do to independent firms or small firms or contractors or disguised forms of employment like gig jobs. This is something that has to be brought under control as well to allow normal wage increases again. So there's a whole slate of policy measures that can be taken. No single magic bullet. But clearly government has the power to get a better wage outcome for Australian workers.
And Troy, are they doing any of those things?
Not on the evidence to date. Even when the government talks about something as being a really high priority like infrastructure investment, if you look at the actual figures, at least at the Commonwealth level, it's not that impressive to think about $75 billion over a 10-year period. So the federal government could really get a lot more serious about investing in the type of economic and social infrastructure that we desperately need and that Australians want.
Even in its own industrial relations, the Commonwealth government has hundreds of thousands of workers, and they're still capped by this arbitrary rule that no one who works for the federal government shall get a raise of more than 2%. And yet the Treasurer is going to table a budget with a forecast of wages growing at whatever, 3 or 4%. They're always optimistic in their forecasts, even as the government itself has their hands around the neck of their own employees to limit any wage increases at all. So the hypocrisy of the government to, you know, cry crocodile tears about slow wage growth while actively helping to keep wages down, that hypocrisy is incredible.
I've heard Senator Abetz, for example, warn about the risk of a wages explosion in the public service. Is that anything we need to worry about?
I think Eric Abetz might still be living in the stagflation recession of the mid-1970s. It's pretty clear at the moment that inflation is not our number one macroeconomic policy problem. It's wage stagnation that has been a problem for the last 5 years. And that's the thing that all arms of government at the state and federal level should be committed to addressing.
The low rate of wages growth in Australia is shaping up as a key battleground for the upcoming federal election.
They charge you more to see a doctor. They put up everything except your wages.
With wage stagnation, the price of rent skyrocketing, and no serious investment into renewable energy, why has the government failed to address these issues that are so important to young people in last week's budget?
The income tax cuts is about putting more money into people's pockets, reward for effort, and therefore to spend and get economic activity when you get it.
Federal Labor has already made increasing wages a key part of its election campaign policy platform, and it has called this election a referendum on wages. The Coalition, in contrast, says that wage rises which do not match better economic conditions will cost jobs. But will the wages crisis change anyone's minds at the ballot box come election day?
Even before the election itself was called, the wages issue was already a top subject of debate in politics and in society, frankly. I've been amazed just in day-to-day conversations I have with people how much public concern there is about the fact that wages aren't growing and how much the old stereotype kind of knee-jerk argument that, you know, we've always got to be on guard, wages could grow too fast, the whole economy could spiral out of control. That argument is yesterday's argument, and people today know that the main problem is trying to have enough money to pay the bills.
Absolutely. We've heard a lot in recent weeks about the concept of a living wage. Troy, how is that different to a minimum wage?
Well, the minimum wage is set by the Fair Work Commission, and that's set on an annual basis, and there are various submissions made. And at the moment, it's about $18.93 an hour. Right, and which means if you have a full-time job on the minimum wage, you might be able to just get by. But a lot of minimum wage workers are working part-time or on some insecure form of employment. So that is why people on the minimum wage can be living in poverty. The living wage is a broader concept, and you can approach it in a couple of different ways. One, you can say, look, we need to get this minimum wage up to about 60% of median earnings in order for it to constitute a living wage. Or we can look at it from a bottom-up approach and look at the different aspects of the cost of living that people face today, which are not all identical, and see what you need in order to live a decent, dignified life in Australia today, and then use that as the basis for determining a living wage.
So there's a couple of ways to approach it, but essentially the concept would be that you shouldn't be able to work a full-time job and be in poverty.
That's the value judgment, that someone who's employed and working full-time should at least be able to get themselves and their family out of poverty. And the living wage idea actually has a long history in Australia. It dates back to the early 20th century and the famous Harvester decision, when early arbitration boards decided that the wage had to be at a certain level so that a family of two adults and three children, that was the one they were using as the stereotypical family back then, could be supported off of one worker, so you assumed to be the man back then, the man's wages. So obviously family structures have changed, the quality and cost of living has changed, but that core philosophy that someone who works shouldn't be in poverty, I think, is as valid as it ever was.
We want to ensure that those relatively small number of Australian adults who rely on the minimum wage aren't in poverty.
23-year-old was on the minimum wage for several years.
It is hard living on barely nothing when you have bills to pay and you just can't afford them.
Our minimum wage is far too low. It leaves full-time workers in poverty.
Aside from talking about average wages not increasing in real terms, there have also been many calls to lift Australia's minimum wage, which is currently set at $18.93 an hour. Last year, the Fair Work Commission increased the national minimum wage by 3.5% per hour to help Australia's 2.2 million lowest paid workers. Labor is now promising that if it wins the election, it will instruct the Fair Work Commission to lift the minimum wage to a living wage.
What would be the impact on the economy if workers started getting that larger share of the pie in the form of higher wages?
There'd be all kinds of benefits. First of all, you get a strong improvement in consumer spending because, you know, Workers, when they get paid, generally go out and spend their money in pretty short order.
I sure do.
Sometimes, thanks to the magic of credit, they spend it before they get paid.
I do that too.
But in any event, you're going to see much stronger consumer spending. And consumer spending makes up about half of GDP. So it's the most important thing going for us. You'll also see, I think, a reduction in household financial stress. Australian consumers are actually among the most indebted in the whole world. Personal debt in Australia is about 200% of their disposable income. So if you're making more money, then you can kind of get your debts under better control. You'll see stronger government revenues flowing, and you'll see a reduction in inequality. So even from the business point of view, it's going to be beneficial. Because remember, businesses, yeah, each one of them would rather pay their own workers less because it means they get more profit. But they can't forget, they have to sell to somebody, and they need a market that has money to spend. So collectively, businesses will be better off if wages are growing again.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because it's often the very first line of defense against the argument for increasing wages is, oh, well, that will put a whole bunch of people out of a job because businesses won't be able to afford to employ them. Does that really stack up, Troy?
Not on the basis of recent research. So some recent economic research from economists like Kruger and Card and also from our own Reserve Bank has shown that there's very little impact on employment from higher minimum wages.
And there's all kinds of ways that employers can adjust to higher minimum wages. For example, one of the benefits is if they're paying more, their staff turnover tends to fall, because people stick with the job longer if it's well paid. And then the employers spend less on recruitment, retention, and training expenses. Productivity tends to grow when minimum wages are higher. And at the same time, of course, consumers have more money to spend. On that score, I always find it incredibly ironic that usually the loudest voices calling for lower wages or to eliminate penalty rates or any other measures like that come from the small business sector in the retail and hospitality industries. And yet those are the industries that are the most directly dependent on consumers having money in their pockets. You know, and if people have more money to spend, it is precisely restaurants and bars and cafes and retail shops that are going to feel the benefits first. So even the small business community, which tends to be the most loudmouthed opposing higher minimum wages, I think they need to take a broader view and recognize that this can benefit them as well as all of society.
I'll paraphrase a quote from one of the great Canadian economists, J.K. Galbraith, who always found it interesting that there was a strong argument from some economists and business people that people on high incomes needed lower taxes to incentivize them to work, whereas people on low incomes needed a cut in wages to incentivize them to work.
That's been episode 34 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. It was recorded on the 3rd of April 2019 in Canberra with Jim Stanford and Troy Henderson. But by the time you hear this, the election campaign will be in full swing. To find more research on wages growth and the minimum wage debate, you can visit the Australia Institute's Centre for Future Work website. That's futurework.org.au. You can listen free to Follow the Money wherever you get your favourite podcasts, or hear previous episodes on our website at tai.org.au/podcasts. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Jim Stanford is at Jimbo Stanford with no D in the middle there. Troy Henderson is Troy C. Henderson with a C for cat in the middle. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, who I'd like to thank once again for filling in for me while I had laryngitis for a month. And additional production was by Lizzie Jack. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.